You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Welcome to this Thursday edition of Midori House. We're live from Studio One on Monocle 24. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in today's show, we meet the Seychelles High Commissioner to the UK to find out how piracy is ruining these idyllic Indian Ocean islands. I'll be talking to comedian and campaigner Mark Thomas about extreme rambling, his attempt to walk the length of the Israel barrier. Our design editor Hugo MacDonald will be joining me in the studio to discuss quiet cities. And finally, we'll be talking about words. Douglas Gayton, founder of the Lexicon of Sustainability, will be explaining the importance of understanding the basic vocab needed to live a sustainable life. As if that wasn't enough, we'll also be playing you some music. And not just any old music. Oh no. Today's playlist has been carefully chosen by Monocle's guest music editor, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. I'm not making that up. All that to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. But first, here's the latest news from around the world with David Hedges.
Monocle 24 News. A Belgian school pastor has expressed anger at Swiss authorities for refusing permission for the bodies of those killed in a coach crash to be brought back home. 22 children aged 11 and 12 were killed when the coach carrying 52 people hit the side of a tunnel on the way back from a school ski trip in Switzerland. 24 of the children were from the St. Lambertus School in Heverlee, a town in Belgium's northern Dutch-speaking region of Flanders. School Pastor Dirk de Gent told a news conference that they were furious at the lack of information.
Our mayor was furious that in a civil country that we have to wait such a long time before we know the exact names, before we know definitely the situation. It's terrible.
Bahrain is shutting down its embassy in Damascus and withdrawing all diplomats and staff because of worsening security conditions there. The news comes as UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged the Syrian government and opposition to cooperate with UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan in a bid to end the violence, saying that the status quo in Syria is indefensible. The uprising in Syria has marked its first year. Today, flag-waving supporters of the president took to the streets in an orchestrated show of loyalty. State television screened thousands of people in central Damascus carrying Syrian flags and portraits of Assad. The Taliban in Afghanistan has suspended initial peace negotiations with the United States. It's blamed the Americans' ever-changing position. One key stumbling block is reported to be US efforts to involve the Afghan government, which the Taliban refuses to recognize. In a near simultaneous announcement, Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai has called for NATO troops to leave Afghan villages. It follows the killing of 16 civilians by US soldier on Sunday. Karzai said the incident had harmed relations between Afghanistan and the United States. German police, facing accusations they've bungled inquiries into a string of murders of immigrants, have launched a campaign to show they are investigating crimes linked to neo-Nazi groups. An Interior Ministry document just released shows police have arrested 46 people and describes the arrests as a success in combating far-right crimes. Chancellor Angela Merkel is also under pressure to ban the far-right National Democratic Party, which has seats in some regional assemblies and, as a result, has access to state funding. The head of the European Union Task Force for Greece has praised the country's government, saying it has performed well to achieve the new bailout agreement. Horst Reichenbach said the country had made progress in sorting tax arrears with the collection of over 900 million euros, more than double the target set. But he warned efforts to change must not stagnate as they have done in the past.
The speed and the intensity with which these prior actions have been taken would be a challenge for any country in Europe. And I think we should also recognize how well this government has performed in order to secure the second package.
It's thought Britain has decided to cooperate with the United States in a bilateral agreement to release strategic oil stocks and prevent high fuel prices, a formal request from the US to the UK to join forces in a release of oil from government-controlled reserves, follows a meeting in Washington between the US President Barack Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron. Meanwhile, Argentina says it will take legal action against any companies involved in oil exploration in the Falkland Islands. British oil explorer Rockhopper has been seeking a partner to invest in the $2 billion Sea Lion project, while Borders and Southern and Falkland Oil and Gas are both set to drill wells to the south of the islands later this year. Argentina's Foreign Minister Hector Timmerman has called the exploration illegal. And those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. Now, it's almost morning, getting there over in Australia. The front pages that people in Sydney and Melbourne will be looking at when they get up and have their breakfast. Sydney Morning Herald, Indonesia urges calm over rise of China. Indonesia has called on Australia to, quote, wage aggressive peace, whatever that means, and to accept that the rise of China is natural and not threatening. This is an interview with Indonesia's Minister for Foreign Affairs with the Herald. And then on the front of the Melbourne Age, Carr sparks diplomatic row. This is Bob Carr, who's going to be the new Foreign Minister under Julia Gillard. He had an interview on Wednesday night where he said that if there was any delay to mid-year elections in Papua New Guinea, it would leave Australia, quote, no alternative but to organise the world to condemn and isolate Papua New Guinea. The Papua New Guinea Foreign Minister wasn't very happy and has called in Australia's acting High Commissioner there to complain. Those are the front pages in Australia that people will be waking up to very shortly. Now it's time for the World Weather Report with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Europe and the weather across France, absolutely stunning end of the week. Sunshine from Lyon to Paris. Some places across the south of France will be as warm as 25 degrees. Sunny for Belgium and Holland. And also warmer and warmer now across Germany and Poland too. If you're off to the UK, sunshine in London at the moment, but the weekend, unfortunately, is looking rainy. Here's Friday's city outlook. In London, 14 degrees, partly cloudy. In Dusseldorf, it's a mild 18 with sunshine. Geneva, 17 degrees and sunny. And in Vienna, 16 degrees and mostly sunny skies. Now across North America, a heat wave has developed across the eastern half of the US. Record-breaking for March, in fact, in some regions. On Wednesday, in St. Louis, Missouri, highs reached 30 degrees, and even in Chicago itself, 27, and it'll stay warm for some days to come. The eastern seaboard of the US looking warm, but not quite as warm. Here's Friday's city outlook. In the Big Apple, it's 18 degrees with some sunshine. Chicago, 23, sunshine and a storm chance here. Indianapolis, 26 degrees with sunny skies, and in Atlanta, also 26, one or two showers here. Around the world, in Hong Kong, starting to warm up here now over the next few days, up to 25 degrees with partly cloudy skies. In Singapore, the usual tropical weather, 31 degrees. And quickly on Australia, a major cyclone is heading to the tropics of the Western Australian state. But in Sydney, of course, nowhere near the region, the weekend will bring sunshine and showers and around 24 degrees. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Thomas. It is 18.08 here in London, 14.08 in New York. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 tonight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 in York.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One with me, Steve Bloomfield. The tiny island state of the Seychelles in the Indian Ocean may be best known for its pristine beaches and idyllic azure waters, but it's fast gaining reputation for something altogether more serious: piracy. Somali pirates, responsible for more than half of the world's piracy attacks, stalk the Indian Ocean, threatening vessels heading for the Seychelles and beyond. What's more, those that are caught by the foreign navies patrolling the ocean often end up in the Seychelles prisons. The jail in the capital Mahé is now overrun with pirates. They account for more than 20% of the prison's entire population. Joining me in the studio now is Bernard Silva, Seychelles Acting High Commissioner to the UK. Bernard, welcome.
Hello.
Paint us a little picture of how dramatically this piracy problem is threatening Seychelles' economy.
Okay, it's affecting us enormously. First of all, Seychelles is a maritime nation. It consists of 120 islands. It has a tiny population, only 72,000. I mean, it's the size of a constituency in the UK, if you like. Everything that comes to Seychelles is imported by sea, and the cost of everything that comes by sea is escalating because of piracy. Our prisons are, as you said in your intro, overflowing. 20% of our prison population is made up of pirates. We have 40 pirates at the moment who are waiting, going through our court system. We've set up an intelligence unit, and recently there was an enormous conference in London called the Somalia Conference. It was called by David Cameron, and 50 countries came with their heads of state or heads of government. Hillary Clinton from the USA and the Secretary General of the United Nations. It was a very high-powered conference, and everybody agrees that the real problem is doing something about Somalia. It's not just piracy in a vacuum. But everything that comes to Seychelles comes by sea, so we have to split up between a number of ships. That puts the cost up. Insurance has gone up. We've had to do something about our courts and about our police and about our coast guards. All of these have had to have money spent on them. We've needed extra aeroplanes. We needed extra boats. It comes to millions of dollars. It's costing us about $2.5 million right now this year. And pirates, you should know, it sounds rather sort of Long John Silverish, if I can use the expression.
Yes, but it's not really, is it?
But it's not at all. They're really nasty people. They're funded by Al Shabaab. Al Shabaab is part of Al Qaeda.
Well, some of them could be funded by Al Shabaab. I mean, there's lots of other
pirates
that are not linked to those groups.
They are all linked to those groups, as far as we know. I mean, it started with there was a thing called Operation Atalanta. It's a wonderful exercise that the European navies have done with their headquarters here in London and headed by the Italian Navy at the moment. And they wanted to keep a corridor down the east coast of Africa in order to get food to the starving people of Somalia. Perfectly reasonable thing to do, but in the process, they were fairly successful. They pushed the pirates south into Seychelles waters, and we've had the problem ever since. Our big our businesses, are tourism and fishery more than anything else, and it's affecting both of them enormously.
I wanted to ask you about tourism, because obviously, you know, that's a huge part of where you get your income from as a country. Has just the reputation or the knowledge that there are pirates anywhere near Seychelles affected the number of tourists that are coming?
It's not putting tourists off, because most of them come by air. What it is doing is putting off cruise ships. And that's always been quite good and important tourist business for Seychelles. And it's putting the cost up for tourists as much as for people who live in Seychelles. Anyone who wants to go sailing and scuba diving and all those things around Seychelles is perfectly safe. And the waters near the main centres of Mahé, which is the main island, and Praline and La Digue are all well policed. It puts off some sailors, yes, but it's affecting the fishing industry enormously. Our own fishermen are at risk. And David Cameron also did something else. He announced that he wants merchant vessels that go through that area of the Indian Ocean up to the Horn of Africa to be accompanied by armed guards. That creates a problem for us as well. We don't like people coming with guns and ammunition into our territory. And so we have to police that. Overall, it escalates. It's not how the exact number of tourists that drops, although the number of tourists has dropped slightly. We managed to hold our own. And considering that the tourist climate anyway is not that great because of the recession, we're not suffering just with tourism.
Let me ask you about this issue of the prisons. I mean, what sort of, you know, you say Seychelles is a country of 72,000 people. You know, your prison population is then fairly small.
It's in small hundreds, yes.
Yes. So to suddenly have, you know, up to 80 pirates suddenly in your prisons.
We have to build a new prison.
Is that what you're doing then at the moment?
Yes. And we're getting help, it must be said, for almost all of these things. We've got the, we get help from the Europeans over patrolling the waters around the Horn of Africa. But there are about four or five ships patrolling an area which is 10 times the size of Germany. And the waters of Seychelles, by the way, although it's a tiny country, the sea area represents probably almost the biggest country in the world. It's bigger than Canada. I mean, it's vast. The area is vast.
And how do you, what happens once these pirates get into your legal system, once they're in prison? In what way, do they have to be found guilty of committing crimes within Seychelles waters, or is it international waters as well?
Both. I mean, we during the Somalia conference, we were held up as the great heroes because we've not only got an intelligence centre developed now in Seychelles, but we also are putting them through our very well-recognised judiciary system, which is about the, with a possible exception of Kenya, is about the only judicial system in the area that is considered to be fair, reasonable and just. So if the Americans catch some pirates, or the Chinese do, or the Russians do, and all those countries, including India as well, they've all been giving us help of various kind, but they all send their pirates to Seychelles.
They essentially turn up on your doorstep. Like the cat turning up on the doorstep with the mouse.
The pirates themselves, they sound very exotic, but they're not. They come along in skiffs. They usually have a mothership. The skiff, you can spot them a mile away because they have ladders in the skiffs. If you see someone getting up a ladder onto a ship, you know...
There's something a little bit dodgy going on.
The ladders are always made of metal and not wood. Why, you ask yourself? Because as soon as they're approached, they dump their arms and their ladders into the sea and there's no evidence. We would like to swap our prisoners or give them back to Somalia and let them go through a good, just system in Somalia. But there's the problem.
Yes.
Somalia is a failed state, and especially the south of Somalia.
Well, I mean, and let's look at that finally. And, you know, this is, you know, it's all very well having, you know, foreign navies patrolling the Indian Ocean, and it's all very well trying to set up systems in Seychelles or elsewhere to deal with pirates that get caught. But that's not going to solve the problem of Somalia, of piracy. I mean, you don't solve that until you solve the problem
of
Somalia.
Everybody agrees you've got to solve the land problem before you can solve the piracy problem. The piracy problem is as a result of the failure of a state in Somalia, more than anything else. And there are effectively three provinces. There's the Puntland, which is reasonably well settled, Somaliland, which is very well settled, but they're threatening to declare UDI and actually go independent.
Become independent.
And the southern part of Somalia is where Al-Shabaab are encamped, and that's where the pirates mainly come from. We know that's where they come from. They are funded from sources other than Al-Qaeda, it's true. Mm. Some of it is just very big business, and it's a scourge.
Yeah, and until that problem is dealt with, you're going to have to muddle through. As it were.
Well, we're not muddling through. We're fighting way beyond our strength and beyond our weight. And I think that we know what the problem is. It also is enormously expensive. I mean, we're talking millions of dollars to get another helicopter, to get another ship for the Coast Guard. It's not just the cost of food coming in. Everything goes up. The cost of fishing for our fishermen, the cost of patrolling them, the cost of the judiciary, the police, the coast guards, everybody is costing us a lot of money and we can't afford it.
Bernard Silver, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
The Urbanist is a show about the cities we live in, and it introduces you to the planners, thinkers and architects who want to make urban life rattle along like a well-tended tram, not grind to halt like a taxi with a flat tyre.
We see that our community is changing, and we have two alternatives. We could make it an eyesore in the community, or we can make it a shining jewel. And we chose to make it a shining jewel.
Leave the countryside to the softies, and listen to the show that knows that a bit of grit and bustle is good for you.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with the Spanish Tourist Office. with bureaus in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York and Zurich, and over 25 correspondents around the world, Monocle has an experienced team of editors and journalists filing for us around the clock. From our bureau in Tokyo, Kenji Hall covers Japan and beyond.
I've kicked the tires of the Taiwanese president's motorcade, and in the span of just a couple of weeks, I've swung through more than a dozen cities across Japan, from Hiroshima to Sapporo, for Monocle's Japan Guide. The best part, though, is that I get to live in Tokyo. There's really no better city to get lost in and to mingle with world-class architects, artists, and artisans. It's a city where food and fashion are a religion, where designers like Naoto Fukasawa turn everyday products into art.
That was Monocle's Kenji Hall, our man in Tokyo.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now it's time for some music. And as promised, we've handed over control of the Monocle 24 playlist to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Earlier today, some 3,000 emails downloaded from the private accounts of Assad and his wife Asma were released. I think you can find them in The Guardian and many other newspapers now. Among the emails were a series of receipts for iTunes purchases. The choices were eclectic, to put it mildly. So kicking us off is Look At Me Now by Chris Brown featuring Lil Wayne and Busta Rhymes.
Yellow model jig, yellow bottle sipping, yellow Lamborghini, yellow top missing. Yeah, yeah, that shit look like a toupee. I get what you get in 10 years. Little nigga, bigger than gorilla, cause I'm killing every nigga that can try to be on my shit. Better cuff your chick if you with it, I can get it, and she accidentally slip and fall on my dick. Oops, I said on my dick. I ain't really mean to say on my dick, but since we talking about my dick, all of you here to say hi to it. I'm done.
Yeah, I think we've had enough of that. But anyway, that was we'll have more Assad tunes later, I promise, and hopefully they'll be slightly better than that. Now, in celebration of Monocle issue 52 hitting newsstands and doormats around the world this week, we're going a little deeper into some of our favourite stories. And today, as it's Thursday, it's the design section. I'm joined by Hugo MacDonald, Monocle's design editor, to elaborate on the column he wrote for the design section. Hello, Hugo.
Hello, Steve.
Now, it's called The 24-Hour Hangover. I'm guessing it's more about... It's not just your tips for a good night out, no?
No, it's not.
Okay, good.
It's really not at all. It was something that struck me after I'd been doing the annual tour of various cities in Europe at the beginning of the year where the first design fairs take place. And, you know, used to living in London and have spent some time in Tokyo and some time in New York. Those are cities that never sleep. And they sort of wear that as a badge of pride.
Yeah, and the idea of being a 24-hour city is...
Exactly.
Cities like to celebrate that.
Glamorous. Something that, particularly in the last decade, people thought that it was the pinnacle of urban glamour and the height of sophistication if you could do your laundry at 4 in the morning and eat whatever you liked whenever you wanted.
At 4 in the morning?
Well, I know. For some reason, doing your laundry in the middle of the night was something that they always spoke about in these cities.
And it doesn't scream glamour, does it?
Well, no, it doesn't really, now that you think about it. But anyway, stop spoiling my story.
Oh, sorry.
I grew up thinking that London was really the only place in Europe to live precisely for that. And then on this tour of smaller European cities that I did at the start of the year that took in Cologne, Zurich, Rome, Stockholm, Helsinki, Budapest, the usual suspects, it suddenly occurred to me that these were cities that really did switch off at night and people closed, shutters were pulled down, lights were switched off, and you couldn't get a drink after midnight unless you really knocked on doors or you knew where to go. And there wasn't sort of street food litter all over the place, and everything come morning was spick and span and people felt fresh. And that to me seems the sort of dignity of cities that learn to go to bed at night is something that we're celebrating a little bit more nowadays, because what we're seeing in these 24-hour cities of old is that budgets have been cut, streets aren't being cleaned as much. People just don't have as much money to spend and want to be out drinking, eating all hours of the day and night. And so cities that have sort of still remain open 24 hours a day but don't have the people and the funds to fill it or keep it clean suddenly feel a little bit depressing.
But is this also about a difference between the sort of city you want to live in and the sort of city you want to visit? I mean, if you were to live in a city like, say, Budapest, where things close at 10 and, you know, you have to do your laundry at normal hours, would you get a little bit bored?
Of living there? No, I don't think so at all. I think that it's something that many of the local people who I spoke to, and I said, I just can't believe that nobody is out in the streets beyond 11 p.m. And they say, well, I know, isn't it nice, actually? And you think after a second, God, actually, it is really nice. There's nobody being sick on a street corner. There's no great rabble of rowdy people tearing up and down the streets at 3 in the morning. Mm. That's, you know, obviously quite fun every now and then. But the older you get, the more you think, I don't really want that happening on my street.
No, but say a city like Barcelona or, you know, anywhere else in Spain where things only really get started at 10 p.m. at night.
But Spain is an entity in itself. I think they're on a slightly different agenda.
The exception that proves the rule.
Yeah, well, they do it at sort of 3 in the afternoon instead, where they all close their shutters and you can't do anything until about 9 p.m. at night. That in itself is, I suppose, they're just on a different clock. It's downtime, really, and it's the fact that cities need downtime. It's not supposed to be somewhere that should be open and functioning 24 hours a day.
Do you get a sense that, you know, cities like London, New York, that have sold themselves as cities that never sleep, as 24-hour cities, are now starting to rethink that?
I think so, definitely. The example I cite in the column that I wrote, I was out in the very, very early hours in central London and visiting somewhere that used to be a complete hub of night creatures, sort of 5 years ago even. Mm. It serves an English breakfast 24 hours a day. And 5 years ago, it would have been absolutely packed all night, and the staff loved working there. They were sort of as much a part of the fun as the food that you were eating and the fact that you could be eating it at that time of the night. But I went recently on my way home, and it was probably about 4 in the morning, and it was filthy, as were the streets, and the streets were fairly empty by that time. And there were just two very miserable-looking staff who sort of looked a bit shocked that anybody really did actually want to partake in an English breakfast at 4 in the morning. And then suddenly, you go, God, it's so unnatural. Why would anybody want to eat English breakfast at 4 in the morning unless you were so drunk, which I wasn't.
Or you got up very early.
Or you'd
to
got
do
up
your
early,
laundry.
But then even so, that. I mean, we find ourselves getting up early the whole time. I could no sooner sit down in front of a full English breakfast at 4 or 5 or until 9 a.m. Than I could eat an egg, full stop, actually.
Excellent. Hugo McDonald, thank you very much. If you want to read more about Hugo's thoughts on 24-hour city, it's in the current issue of Monocle. What page, Hugo?
Page 128.
Excellent.
There's a nice picture of me there too.
There is indeed. Hugo, we're going to play some music now. We're going to play something else from the Assad playlist.
Go for it, Steve.
This is God Gave Me You by Blake Shelton, who's an American country star. And what's odd about this, slightly creepy, is that Assad allegedly sent the lyrics of this song to his wife, Asma, the day before the first bombardment of Homs. So anyway, if that makes you think of Homs and attacking it, here is Blake Shelton.
Flattered fool, and I need you. Yeah, God gave me you for the ups and downs.
That was God Gave Me You by Blake Shelton, chosen by Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be hearing from Mark Thomas and discussing the lexicon of sustainability and, of course, delving further into the Assad playlist. But first, here's David Hedges with the news headlines.
A Belgian school pastor has expressed anger at authorities in Switzerland for delaying permission for the bodies of those killed in a coach crash to be brought back home. 22 children aged 11 and 12 were killed when the coach carrying 52 people hit the side of a tunnel on the way back from a school ski trip. Bahrain is shutting down its embassy in Damascus and withdrawing all diplomats and staff because of worsening security conditions there. The news comes as UN Secretary-General General Ban Ki-moon urged the Syrian government and opposition to cooperate with UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan in a bid to end the violence, saying that the status quo in Syria is indefensible. The Taliban in Afghanistan has suspended initial peace negotiations with the United States. In a near simultaneous announcement, Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai has called for NATO's troops to leave Afghan villages. It follows the killing of 16 civilians by US soldiers Sunday. The head of the European Union Task Force for Greece has praised the country's government, saying it has performed well to achieve the new bailout agreement. Horst Reichenbach said the country had made progress in sorting tax arrears. Argentina says it will take legal action against any companies involved in oil exploration in the Falkland Islands. The foreign minister, Hector Timmerman, has called plans to drill wells there illegal. And those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
This is Midori House. I'm Steve Bloomfield. For more than two decades, Mark Thomas has been combining comedy with campaigning, poking fun at and causing problems to some of the world's most powerful governments and multinationals. Now he's turned his attention to Israel and Palestine, or to be precise, the barrier built by Israel which splits part of the country from the West Bank. A little earlier, Mark came into Midori House to talk to me about his career so far and his latest project. Let's start by talking about the book Extreme Rambling. Rambling is a very British pastime. We all like to go out into the countryside and go for a bit of a walk. We all like to ramble with words as well. Tell us, what is extreme rambling?
Well, what I did was I walked along the length of the Israeli barrier in the West Bank, using the wall basically as a route map, and starting at the beginning of the northeast corner of it, and then following the wall all the way around, walking on both sides, talking to folk on both sides, and generally getting into trouble and finding things out, or trying to find out as much as you can. It just struck me that if you wanted to try and understand a bit more about a conflict involving culture and identity and land, then one of the best ways to find out about it was walking and talking.
Let's talk about the wall itself, which, you know, the Israeli government called a security barrier. They claim it's needed to keep terrorists out of their side. What does it look like, and what, when you're up close to it, what does it feel like?
Well, it changes all the time. It is, there's probably only about 5% of it which is actually made of concrete, and the rest is, it's a military barrier. So you have, out in the countryside, you have pyramids of barbed wire, which will start on the Palestinian side, which are quite high. This is roughly what you get as a standard structure. Yeah. Then you get a ditch, some kind of trench. Then you have a no man's land. Then you have the wire fence. And next to it on the Palestinian side would be a sand trap path, which shows your footprints if anyone's walking near it. The fence is electronic, covered in motion detectors. You touch it, signal sent out to the war room, patrol dispatched immediately. Then on the Israeli side, you have another sand trap path. Then you have the military patrol road, which is patrolled 24 hours a day by the Israeli border patrol, known as the MAGAF or the IDF. They're overseen by a series of watchtowers, camera range, 6 kilometres. Then you get another no man's land. Then you get another ditch. Then you get another pyramid of barbed wire. So you get three at the bottom, two in the middle, one at the top. Coils of razor wire. That's roughly what you get.
And you travelled on both sides,
yeah,
switching between two. How easy is it to do that, to hop, as it were, from one side to the other?
It's an interesting thing because some checkpoints you can get through, some are just for workers, so you're not allowed to get through if you have got a British passport, for example. Some that are just open for a short amount of time. The bizarre thing about it is the wall is essentially used as an extension of the occupation. There are lots of people who've said, you know, it is to stop the suicide bombers getting through. Mm. And that, I think, was the initial impulse that caused people to call for the wall to go up. Once the decision to put the wall up is made, we're going to put the wall up, then it becomes the servant of many different masters. And people can say, right, we want to take this bit of land here. We want it to go around settlements. We want to take it water rights here. So nearly 10% of the West Bank land that is Palestinian land ends up on the Israeli side of the wall because the wall goes in and out of the West Bank, which is why it was declared illegal in 2004, or the route of the wall was declared illegal by the International Court of Justice. So you have this wall that is the servant of many masters, serves many different things, incredibly oppressive. I mean, genuinely oppressive. Well, that was the shocking thing about it.
That's what I'm talking about. I mean, how does it affect the psychology of a place? If you are living in a village and, you know, it used to be all trees around here and now there's a this massive wall.
It won't be just the fact that there are all trees around here. It's now my trees are on the other side of the wall.
Right.
And now the settlers who are trying to cut down my trees to build upon. And it's a whole range of things. It has huge effect. I mean, it has a massive effect on the economy. 50% unemployment for men in Jenin up in the north, which is monumental. That's enormous. The World Bank and the IMF are saying that the restrictions of freedom of movement are causing the collapse of the West Bank economy. So there's an enormous impact that it has, and psychologically as well as sort of economically, socially, you know, people deprive access, they can't move from one side to another. There's a whole process by which settlers in East Jerusalem are trying to move out Palestinian communities and push them over the wall. There's a whole range of things that are happening there. And so it's a really interesting place to walk. And bizarrely, it's beautiful. You know, the countryside is utterly incredible. We're walking on our first day with these Palestinian guys who'll be walking on giving us lectures about the refugee crisis and then suddenly go, oh, wild asparagus. And, you know, we'd be off picking this stuff up. Or they'd be going, look, mushrooms. And, you know, and you'd suddenly find all this stuff, which is incredibly beautiful, incredibly fertile land. And just and people sort of, generally speaking, very welcoming. And so it was an incredible sort of adventure to go and do this thing.
I'm intrigued by what you found on the Israeli side, because I think, you know, we can imagine what people would say or what they would think on the Palestinian side. But, you know, this wall was put up, you know, by the Israeli government. It was seen as something that would be a good thing for Israel. Do the people in Israel who live on, like, right up next to it, did you get the sense that they are happy with it, see it as,
there's,
well, we don't
happy
with
feelings.
It, but we
there's
understand lot, why it needs to be there.
There's a lot of mixed feelings about this. Along the route of the wall, you do not get what would be classified as your bog-standard Israelis. Bog-standard Israelis tend to live in places like Tel Aviv. And often people would talk about the wall as you know, somewhere far, far away. You know, it doesn't impinge upon them. People would refer to the Tel Aviv bubble, where reality or their perception of reality doesn't impinge upon them. What's interesting is the people who, if the wall goes around so many settlements, there's 500,000 settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Generally speaking, people think the wall has stopped suicide bombers. I would suggest that this might be wishful thinking. And I'd suggest it's wishful thinking for several reasons. One is there was a bomb that went off a little while ago after the wall had gone up in Jerusalem. It happened. 20% of the Israeli population are what are called Israeli Arabs, Palestinians. There were uprisings during the Second Intifada in various Palestinian cities and towns in Israel. So this idea that somehow all the Palestinians are on the other side is nuts. It's not true. Secondly, the wall isn't finished. You can literally, there's incredible paradox, incredibly oppressive, and yet there's bits of it where you can walk around the edge. You can just, it just stops. They haven't finished building it. Down in
and
place,
what happens if you do walk around the edge?
Nothing. I've walked around the edge of this wall and just went, I've just walked around, I was walking around the West Bank and you get to the edge and you just go into Israel. And it's just like, oh, we're here. And it is the most bizarre thing. You know, there are a series of tunnels in a place called Hadda, Al-Hadda. And if you go under them, you just come out on the other side. You know, and they're tunnels that are used
and the tunnels
for,
are legal, they're fine.
No, they're
there.
Legal. They're legal tunnels that have been built for herders and cattle and all of that kind of stuff on this one particular instance. And that will happen in one small area. And yet, sort of miles up the road, it's just dreadful. You won't get through no matter what. So you come across these really... And down in the south, I mean, we climbed over the wall. They hadn't finished, but they were making a quarry. There's a quarry which goes into the West Bank. So it's quite hard because a quarry continues moving. Because you just cut away, it's quite hard to build a wall around it because it's continually moving. So they just have these concrete blocks, like road things that you find in a road to redirect traffic when sort of repairs are being done. And you can just slip over them. So you have this incredible thing where on one hand it's very repressive, on the other hand it just... It's not there in parts. But the biggest thing I would point to is the fact that thousands of Palestinians crossed the wall illegally. And we've joined them on occasion, we've watched them, we've heard the reports. And you see people crawling through sewage pipes, getting into rubbish vans to go through checkpoints, hiding in boots of cars, breaking across bits which aren't built on yet, climbing over, you know, at one point we walk along, there's just a ladder leaning against the wall where someone's just, that's where they've gone over.
I want to talk a little bit more broadly about your work, because it's, you know, you've been doing this for 2 decades or more?
I think 25 years.
25 years, okay. And it's a combination of comedy and campaigning. Is that fair to describe it as that?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a different mix from, you know, from most campaigners and most comedians.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing is a lot of people do observational comedy. You know, you look at the world around you and you write jokes about it. And, you know, all of us do that to a certain degree. If you're a writer, if you're a creative person, what you do is you write about things you know. That's the biggest thing. That's the biggest, most important impulse you have, things around you, and how you react to them, interpret them. My point was very simple, which is, if you want to do observational comedy, why not observe something really interesting rather than just the everyday? Why not go and observe something, you know, really bizarre? I did a show called the Mark Thomas Comedy Product, where really it was inspired by pranksters and you know, situationists and punk and all these different
but
ideas.
But it was pranks on, you know, government officials and,
yes,
you know, yeah, no, shady arms dealers.
Yeah, it wasn't about sort of walking close behind a woman and filming her for 15 minutes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It wasn't that kind of stuff. And one of the first things we did was we got these politicians. It was coming up to an election and we got these Tory politicians in who were going to lose their seats, and they desperately wanted publicity and attention. So we got them into the studio and said it's a youth programme. And I would appear dressed as a bear, as a teddy bear. And they would sit on this thing and I'd go, do you like honey? And they go, oh, yes. I said, do you like Winnie the Pooh? Oh, I love Winnie the Pooh, yes. And there's one chap, I said, I asked him these questions. He goes, yes, I love British honey, marvellous. I said, you're pro-life and pro-capital punishment, so what age do you think we should kill him? And he just, and there's this wonderful thing where this bloke in a teddy bear costume asked this politician a question about morality and abortion and capital punishment. That was interesting. But then you find, well, we can actually create our own story.
Well,
we can actually go and dig out stories and go, look, here's something that's going on, and we can invest time in and finding out and expose it.
Do you get the sense that, you know, over the last 2 decades, the outlets that you have for this sort of work have changed somewhat?
Yeah. We used to do some of the stuff we did, we wouldn't get away with now. I know we wouldn't get away with it. We snuck in between the IRA ceasefire and Al-Qaeda. That's what happened. Well, there was a window and we snuck in the middle of it, right? I remember a friend of mine, he'd been talking to, I bumped into him and he said, I'm really, really angry with you. I said, why? What have I done? He said, I spent 6 months trying to get a meeting with this television executive. I get this television executive into a room, a phone goes and he goes, oh my God, I've got to go and stop Mark Thomas projecting onto the MI6 building, and then leaves. And we just got in. It was very, the stuff like that wouldn't happen. We wouldn't be able to get away with it.
You work on a lot of different, you know, political campaigns, whether it's, you know, trying to stand up to arms dealers, or it's like this in Israel and the Palestinian territories. Do you consider yourself an optimist?
I think I used to consider myself an optimist all the time. I would say yes, because the fact.
And what changed?
Every time you tell a joke, George Orwell used to say every joke was a revolution. It was a small revolution. A friend of mine used to do this.
I wouldn't
thing.
Say all knock-knock jokes are small revolutions.
You don't know. If you tell a joke about a politician, or if you tell a joke about the way things are, what you're saying is there should be a better way inherently within it. If you criticise the way we are, you're saying there has to be a better way. So inherently, I used to think that all comedy was optimistic because we were saying there has to be a better way. And sometimes you would find that way. Why can't we do this? Doesn't this make more sense? And we would, you know, you actually show that you show there can be a better way. And then with campaigning and with the product and various stuff, I was very much involved in this idea where you could change things. And so I was hugely optimistic. I am less optimistic these days, not because I don't think we can change things, but because it's harder. I suppose what happens is people feel that this is the way things are and you just can't change it. I've always thought you can change it, but bloody hell, we've got a lot of work to do.
That was Mark Thomas talking to me a little earlier. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're heading to California right after this.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly business briefing, looking at the most inspiring people, places and ideas from around the world. Whether it's a bookshop owner in Toronto with a smart new business model, a fast food entrepreneur taking Japan by storm, or a local bank CEO providing microfinancing in Kenya, our correspondents and editors are on hand to provide insight into self-started success. Each week, we'll be talking to enterprising people who have taken the leap and followed their dreams to set out on their own.
This is not just purely a business. This is a lifestyle. It's fun. It's great. I wake up in the morning, every morning, excited about what are these crazy ideas going around in my head.
From branding your company to finding startup financing and surviving the tough times, we cover the full range of what it takes to turn an idea into a thriving business. All told through personal stories from real people finding success by following their ambitions.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet. With a team of 25 dedicated correspondents and bureaus in Zurich, Tokyo, Hong Kong and New York, Monocle 24 keeps you fully informed on events around the world, around the clock.
For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
For Monocle in Abu Dhabi, I'm Christopher Lord.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv.
In Sao Paulo.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Manama. In Paris.
In Ramallah.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Bangkok.
Los Angeles.
In London.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
In Toronto.
In Laetitia.
Keeping an eye and an ear on the world. This is Monocle 24.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 18:47 here in London, 11:47 in California, which is where we head right now. Now, we at Monocle are, it's fair to say, rather particular when it comes to words. The right expression, the perfect turn of phrase can make a story sing and a piece of script flow. My next guest, Douglas Gayton, shares a similar passion, although his love of the perfect word perhaps has a more concrete purpose. His new project is called The Lexicon of Sustainability. In short, he argues people cannot be expected to live a more sustainable life if they don't know the basic terms that define sustainability. He joins me on the line now. Douglas, welcome. Where did the idea then for this lexicon come from?
Well, I had just finished my last book, which was explaining the slow food movement. And I was at a table of rather enlightened people in the food movement, and somebody was speaking about food miles, and they referred to it as the distance that they had to go to actually get their food, when actually food miles is a way to actually measure how much distance things have to travel to reach you. The fact that they had gotten that word backwards and actually didn't understand the most basic kind of concept behind the term made me think that if I was at a table full of very enlightened, savvy people, what must the general public think when they are confronted with this bombardment of words and terms that they have no idea what they mean? I set out to find that out.
So let's start at the beginning in terms of how you put together this lexicon in the first place. I mean, how many words and phrases do you have at the moment?
Well, when we first began, we thought it was pretty simple. We'll just gather researchers. We'll spend 6 months and put all these terms together. And we ended up, we had thousands of them. And we could have published them in a book. It would have been a book that you would have bought to feel good about yourself, but probably would have never read because it would have been so dense with so much information.
It would look good on the bookcase, though. It would be impressive.
It would be the thing that would make you look very smart to your friends at Christmas time. But we thought, instead of doing that, let's just dig down and really understand one aspect of sustainability. So we started with food and farming. We have about 500 terms, and for the past 3 years, we've been going around the United States asking people that really define the conversation in food and farming in this country to give us the one single term or idea or word or principle that defines what they do. And then from that, we've been building this lexicon.
And so once you have these words, how do you, and please do, pardon the pun, spread the word?
Well, our project is fairly simple. We make large size information artworks that use up to 100 or 200 images to create a very large collage that is depicts what that word means, almost always with the person who is defining it in the image. And then we actually have the people who are in the image do all of the writing to explain what that term means. And then we actually etch it into the photograph. And it's a very laborious process. It can take up to a month to do. Sometimes just arguing over what's going to go into the actual writing of an image can take up to a year. We've had some images that have taken that long to do. And then we end up with artworks that are about 4 or 5 feet across. And they are now traveling and will be appearing in about 500 shows in the United States this year.
So you do a series of these pop-up art shows and installations across the US. Give us a flavor of some of the words, the more unusual words and phrases that we should be more aware of.
Well, I'll actually invert that.
Okay.
In that people always say to me, that sounds like a very complicated project. That sounds like a lot of work. What's the one word that I should know?
Yeah.
And I always start by saying local. And they say, well, I already know that word. And I say, well, then you're halfway there. Because so much of sustainability is reconnecting to what is close, to what is part of your local community. Like in terms of a food system, when you become more local, you begin, for example, eating with the seasons, something that we don't really have to do when we have 24-hour supermarkets that can get us strawberries or asparagus, every day of the year. So when we start to become more local and we start to eat with the seasons, we can really have much less of a carbon footprint and be much more connected to our communities. But in terms of the phrases that you are hearing in the United States, which are really going to be part of the public conversation, I think, 2012, is a backlash against organic certification, is against all of the terms that are surrounding that. And there are now new terms like face certification, which means you buy from me because you know my face and you know the type of person I am and how I'm probably going to raise the produce that you're buying. There's another term that's appearing across the country, which is called local first, certification second, which is that you should give greater priority to things that are local, and that is more important than things that are actually organically certified.
Is part of the problem actually with a lot of these words and phrases is that they are they're kind of quite complicated, and they sort of, if you understand the jargon, then it all makes sense, but if you don't, then you don't. And actually maybe simpler, more straightforward words rather than phrases like face certification might be more useful.
Well, I always explain it this way, which is, people always say to me, what is the power of words? Why is it so important for us to know what these words mean? And I actually, I always say to people, if you learn what a term means, you can actually shift how an industry functions. And the example of that is the term cage-free. When people first heard the term cage-free, they said, wow, a chicken out of a cage. That sounds like a pretty good idea. I think I want a cage-free egg because it might taste better. I don't know why, but it sounds like it might. And it might be better for the chicken, so I want a cage-free egg. That simple decision that people made when they were standing looking at eggs lining a supermarket shelf actually forced an industry to shift, forced people to then start thinking about, what free range might be, which actually, as it turns out, is a weasel word as well.
That's the one that's more common here in the UK, it's free range.
Well, ironically, I certainly can't speak to the UK, but in the United States, free range technically doesn't really mean anything. And what we're seeing now, the term that people are going to be looking for and seeing across the United States, and I would imagine also in the UK in 2012, is going to be the term pasture-raised.
Pasture-raised.
Pasture-raised will be the new term that we're now seeing farmers markets around the United States only allowing pasture-raised poultry and pasture-raised eggs to be sold at their farmers markets. Again, this is it's an attempt to continually clarify how language is used, what it means, and to constantly stay ahead of people who basically tend to exploit people's misunderstanding of what words mean.
Douglas Gayton, thank you very much indeed. We will look out for Pasture Raised. The Lexicon of Sustainability is the project. You're listening to Midori House, and we're going to play you, I think, one more song, which is a favourite of Bashar al-Assad. And this is, I can't believe we're playing this, but actually is a rather a good version. This is Leona Lewis and her version of Johnny Cash's version of Nine Inch Nails, Hurt. That was Hurt by Leona Lewis. And that is it for this edition of Midori House. I just want to give you an idea of the songs we didn't choose, which we could have, that were on the Assad playlist. Don't Talk, Just Kiss by Right Said Fred. We could have had that. Bizarre Love Triangle, which is actually rather good, by New Order. And this one I'm really glad we didn't, which was a tribute to Cliff Richard by 21st Century Christmas. That is everything for Midori House. The show is produced by Hannah Jenkins. Researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Monocle Daily will be here at 2200 London time to start the day in Asia. Next on Monocle 24 is The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. Stay tuned for that. This has been Midori House. Goodbye.